So we're a couple of weeks into this series on modern Midrash, and I actually met a rabbi, and I asked him how to say it, and he had an accent, so I can't. Midrash is as close as I can get. And if it is a new word for you, as it was to me, apparently it's used quite a lot, but seldom defined. And so it seems to be involving taking a topic that has various sides to it and learning more about the topic through wrestling with the tension. It's more of an intellectual wrestle than it is a physical. So if you go to a Super Bowl party and you say, "Oi, what a midrash," that's probably not going to do it for you. So I'll just save you the embarrassment. Don't. Now, I feel a little uncomfortable calling this a sermon today because it's not really biblically based. There's not a lot of theology or concepts of the Bible. But as we've been talking about Midrash, it seemed to be a good idea to me to talk about how to talk about the things that cause tension. So think of this sermon, as it were, as kind of a parenthesis between the good biblical context, the context that you got last week and you will get again next week, if that's okay. So back in the 1970s, Ben's folks lived in Sacramento, and we lived in Pasadena, which was some 7.5 hours away. And periodically, we would take the trek up there to see them. And we'd usually leave around 4 o'clock in the afternoon so that Ben could get in something of a full day's work. And we'd arrive around midnight. And, you know, after a full day's work, Ben would be kind of tired as he was driving up there. And at that point, I didn't have the love of driving on freeways that I have now. So it all fell to him. And I don't know if you have taken the trek between here and there, but it's either the 5 or the 99, and either of them are pretty much mind-numbingly boring. And when you think of the highlight of the trip is either Shafter, Hanford, or Stockton. If those are your hometowns, which I found out that actually there are a couple here from Shafter. So to that I say, I either apologize or say, "I'm so sorry." I'll let you decide which. Anyway, this one particular trip, Ben decided that he'd driven long enough, and he was kind of dozing off, you know, that kind of thing. We tried opening the windows, turning on the air conditioning, we tried turning up the radio, and he was still really struggling. And so I hit upon the perfect stay awake device. I picked a fight. I believe it was the tension between free will and predestination. And I stated a hardline opinion of which I didn't fully believe, but I knew it was contrary to his. So I went with it. And I can pretty much argue on anything, you know, either side. I'm kind of good at that. So we argued probably for, several hours. I'd say 3 or 4. It was passionate, you know. And there was a, "Well, what about, how could you think?" and all of that stuff. And my goal was met. We arrived in Sacramento in one piece, and no blood was spilled, or at least not much. Midrash. The art of learning by steeping in the tension of a topic. You know, we've been a little hard on the evangelical church through the years here. And don't get me wrong, I fully believe the evangelical bubble has popped. But I say that with a bit of love, because we spent quite a lot of our lives in the evangelical church. And I have to say that much of what I am today was born on those pews. So if you'll indulge my nostalgia and admitted simplification a little bit, there's something simple about that traditional evangelical church. It was homogenous. Everyone liked the same things. There were common goals, common beliefs, common culture, common political bent, and so on. It was what we call a closed-set church, a closed-set culture. That's kind of a mathematical term, meaning that it has boundaries and points of limitation. And visually, you can think of a group with a circle drawn around it, or a bubble, as it were, the evangelical bubble. We knew who was in, we knew who was out. We knew who we were, what the rules were, what God expected of us. And we had Bible verses to back it all up. So we felt pretty good about God stamping his seal of approval on the thing. But life in the bubble didn't really fit life in the world. And most of us spent 6 out of 7 days in a world that didn't recognize our bubble, didn't appreciate it. So people either entrenched, or they bifurcated their lives into secular and sacred, or they jumped ship entirely. And if you've studied the trends of the church, you'll see there's been a very, very large number of ship jumpers. So over the last decade, Ventura Vineyard has made a conscious decision to wrestle with trends and issues. And we've made the decision not to be a closed-set community. We decided to dismantle the closed walls and open our doors and welcome anyone who wants to be here and struggle along the journey with us. We adopted a tagline. We are an accepting community without compromise, relentless in our pursuit of our own spirituality, and lavish in our mercy and grace towards others. So what does that mean? Basically, it means everyone's welcome. Our doors are open. And instead of pointing fingers at the specks in other people's eyes, we look for the logs in our own, to coin a biblical phrase. And we recognize that everyone is on a journey, and we're all on different places in that journey. Not all of our journeys look alike. We are accepting without compromise, however. There are things that we believe and teach and we hold to be true. We're followers of Jesus who are learning to follow him more closely. And one reason we exist is to help you learn to follow him more closely too. But we recognize that we're all in different places, which means that the person sitting in front of you or behind you is probably in a different place in the journey than you are. And we continue to hold our series called Modern Midrash this week. We're going to talk about the tension that arises out of being in community with one another, in talking to one another about things that are important to us. Do you know who else dealt with tension in community? Jesus. I mean, think for a minute. Think about the handpicked disciples. Think about what they were before they were handpicked disciples. There were a bunch of fishermen. Some of them were successful, some of them were not. There was a hated tax collector. There was a money guy who was probably some form of bookkeeper or accountant, but a definite bean counter. And just for fun, throw in a terrorist. Because when you read the word zealot in the Bible, it's basically what you're talking about. Someone who incited violence, unrest, stirred things up with the purpose of overthrowing Rome. And then there were a bunch of other backgrounds that we know virtually nothing about. So these folks were together in community. And what held them in community? One thing in common: Jesus. But their community was strong enough that it survived his death, his death and his crucifixion, and decades of persecution as the church was born. So how? Two things. Love. Messy, honest, stepping on toes, falling twice, getting up three times. Love. And another thing, a commitment to a common factor. And that factor was Jesus. So I used to quilt a little bit, not as well as my mother-in-law, but I used to. And there were a couple things I learned about patterns. Quilts could have a unifying color or scheme where everything was hand-picked to go together. A closed-set quilt, if you will. But sometimes the only unifying theme in a quilt was randomness, where things didn't match on purpose, where you take whatever scraps you have on hand and you sew them together, making a quilt block that contains unlike patterns and shapes and the color schemes in sort of an unexpected way. And those things, those quilts are some of my favorites because the only thing that draws you to them is the diversity. And it's intriguing, and it tells a story. If we really want a church that is expansive, welcoming to all, that means each of us needs to be people who are expansive and welcoming to all. All what? Democrats, Republicans, independents, socialists, libertarians, and people who don't give a rip about politics whatsoever. African Americans, Native Americans, Alaskan Natives, Pacific Islanders, Asians, Native Hawaiians, Caucasians, the wealthy, the middle class, the poor, those who drive Mercedeses and those who live in their cars. Some of us who were born into a church with generations of Christ followers behind us, and those who are first-gen believers who are struggling with their faith, those who don't really believe in God at all but are looking for something, those who are just here for the music, those loyal to the vineyard, those who are passing through for a season, and those of you who are here until we tick you off and you go somewhere else. L, G, B, T, Q, and oh yes, H. People who've been married for decades, divorcees, widows, widowers, people who are living with someone in committed relationships, singles who are happy being singles, singles who are seeking a relationship, and those who are passing through relationships with no chance of sticking together at all. Look around you, folks, because today in this building, it's quite possible that many of these categories are represented in one diverse, messy clump of people who may or may not want to learn to love one another. But I believe it's possible to do so. I mean, shoot, if the disciples could, why can't we, right? So there's a sonnet by Shakespeare, and it goes like this. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. So, how do I love you when what you stand for is foreign or repugnant to me? How do I love you when your appearance provokes fear or judgment in me? How do I love you when your beliefs run counter to everything I hold sacred? How? Well, we've got to recognize that we're all on a journey, and likely our values and opinions are going to shift over time, right? And we need to recognize that none of us hold all the answers or have a corner on the truth. Shakespeare again, and I'm quoting from Hamlet, "There are more things in this heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy." Now, I grew up in a family that was sort of waspish with two W's, so we were wealthy white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And one of the values of our family was that we were not ostentatious. We did not flaunt our wealth. That was hammered into me. We lived in a rather modest, very much too small house, if you ask my mother. We drove nice cars, but they were in neutral colors with not too much chrome. We were subtle. We didn't want to stick out in any way, shape, or form. And the funny turn this took is our family did not believe in bumper stickers. My father had this thing about bumper stickers. He said, if you want to know what I think, get to know me, and then I'll tell you. So we never had bumper stickers, and he would make many comments about people who did. It was one of his values, as it were. So imagine how he would have felt about tattoos. And the value sort of planted itself in my psyche, I have to say. So when tattoos became more mainstream and it was people would tattoo themselves other than drunken sailors on shore leave, I began to have to reconsider my position. Because some of my friends were getting tattoos. As a matter of fact, one of my former pastors got a tattoo. And in the 1980s, tattoos were something I still never thought would be inked on a Downing. As a matter of fact, Melissa and I used to have this joke when she was in high school. She'd say, Mom, I have something I need to tell you. And I would always say, does it involve body piercings or tattoos? And we would laugh. And it never did until recently. Now, many of you know Melissa and the journey she's been on. And one day she told me she was going to get a tattoo. Now, I've come a long way in my thoughts about body ink, so I didn't react in horror. And as a matter of fact, I didn't even really feel any horror. A decade before, I would have said, how could you? Or why would you do such a thing to your body? I might have, honestly. Instead, I said, tell me about it. And what she told me was a quite lovely redemptive story about beauty emerging from adversity, of survival and life and joy. My closed-set opinion of tattooing had thankfully broken open enough in time not to ruin a beautiful moment of sharing with my daughter sharing her life with me and of how the deep places of pain had given away to a hope for joy and how she wanted to memorialize that in a permanent, in ink. So I will say it. My daughter has tattoos, and I love them. Now, we're on to something. So let's try it on for size. I want to take one area and explore it a little bit and try some principles out on it. But in the back of your minds, just because I've picked this one area to talk about, the principles can apply to pretty much any area of tension. The racial divide, sexual preference, gender identity, denominational background, whatever. But the area I'm choosing is a little more benign. It's an area that, you know, it's safe, it's non-confrontational. And I think we, you know, all agree on every aspect of it. So that's why I picked it to talk about, and that is politics. And specifically, how to talk about politics without spilling blood. Now, a bit of a caveat before we start. We are a 503c corporation, which means we are a religious nonprofit, and we're not allowed to influence in the direction of a candidate for any reason whatsoever. So I'm going to try really hard to get through this without tipping my hand onto my personal preferences. And if I slip up, please take it as a personal opinion. I'm not trying to influence you. Okay? There's the caveat. Because, see, I'm on a journey, and the way I think right now is probably not the way I'll think in the future. I have changed and morphed over the years. But politics is becoming ever more divisive, isn't it? And it's kind of scooped up human conditions in the fuel of its wake. I mean, take issues, for example. I'm going to read down a list and just pay attention to what happens in you physically when I say some of these words, okay? Ready? Abortion, immigration, universal health care, Supreme Court appointment, fossil fuel, animal testing, white privilege, ACLU, Me Too, vaccinations, social media, climate change, gun control, racism, Dakota Pipeline, death penalty, right to privacy, euthanasia and assisted suicide, GMOs, minimum wage, national anthem protests, police body cameras, recreational marijuana, school vouchers, vaping, teacher tenure, animal rights. So did any of these subjects bring up any feelings at all? Strong feelings? Passionate feelings? See, virtually every one of them is controversial and has two sides to it, if not more. And virtually every one of them has supporters and opponents, likely in this very room. Modern Midrash. Shall we pause and take a breath? See, the problem with politics and political issues, or I say one of the problems, is how we talk about them. We have yes, we're coming up against Thanksgiving. How many of us have dealt with this? I did an informal survey, and I imagine the folks at Barna would be appalled because my sampling was pretty small. Okay, I asked 10 people. But 9 out of 10 had the same answers, so I kind of took it as, you know, persuasive as to what a larger sampling would indicate. Here was my question. What is the point of communication? And the number one answer that I got, the 9 out of 10 answer, was in one form or another to get my point across. I think that's what it's become, but I think we can do better. It's become a lot like this. Like this. Like that. I think communication is something else entirely. The word communicate, if you look back into the 16th century, comes from a Latin term meaning to share and to have in common. And a conversation is meant to have exchange ideas intimately and deeply with those that you live among. It's meant to build relationship. That kind of conversation doesn't build relationship, it tears it. Communication is coming together. It's not adversarial. So how on earth can we communicate and have a conversation about things where we may be polar opposites? It's about love, seriously. It is that simple. If we are an accepting community without compromise, it means we're learning to love one another in the midst of our differences. Because love embraces difference. We're all facets of a diamond, if you think about it. I can't think of a world more boring of billions of me. I just can't. there would be no difference. It would be boring as all get out. And like the quilt I talked about earlier, we're a diverse community here with different beliefs and values. And what is of vital importance to one may be unimportant to another or not even on their radar. Your hot button may run opposite to my deeply held conviction, but you're still important to me. Midrash. If we seek to love as Jesus loved, your differences can actually enhance my way of thinking. If we disagree and I listen to you, maybe I solidify my own idea, or maybe I expand it. Now, how many of you were alive when this movie came out in 1970? Love story. Sappy, tear-jerky, sicky, sweet love story, starring Ryan O'Neal and Ally McGraw. And its climax went like this. Hard-working, middle-class Jenny Cavallari was dying of some dead disease, and her silver-spooned, hideously wealthy boyfriend, Oliver, gave a tearful apology for all of his shortcomings, to which she responded, "Love means never having to say you're sorry." Well, just to illustrate my point of how things change, how many of you saw What's Up, Doc? It came out 2 years later, also starring Ryan O'Neal, but this time with Barbara Streisand. And she says, "Love means never having to say you're sorry." And Ryan O'Neal said, "That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard." Well, I have a different set of ideas of what love means and what it might look like in the context of talking politics to those around us. Love means being willing to move beyond my gut reaction. Love means asking clarifying questions rather than forming rebuttals. Love means being willing to listen to your story, suspending my own judgment. Love means willing to accept the tension of different attitudes, ideas, and ways of being for the sake of the relationship. Love means being willing to learn and value challenging concepts, and even more so, the people who hold them. Love means being willing to consider changing my own ideas. So let's consider something. There's various ways to engage in a political conversation. The first is the debate. When in a debate situation, the purpose is to show how your purpose is or your position is superior to another's. And honestly, this is how we generally converse about politics. And it's largely unsatisfying, ineffective, and very frustrating. And even worse, it can ruin a relationship or ruin a chance of building a relationship. And as you can see from this very scientific graphic, minds don't get changed. However, there is a unifying result. Everyone leaves angry. Next is the diatribe. I like this one. Does that look like Freddie Mercury, I think, a little bit? Differing from a debate, this is when one person dominates the conversation, assuming he or she is correct in all aspects and is generally uninterested in letting the other one get in a word edgewise. If the other person does manage to get a word in edgewise, the first person will cut them off and ridicule them. This technique is being refined on both sides of the aisle in Washington to a new art form, I think. But today we're here to talk about the conversation. The purpose of a conversation is a lot different. In a conversation, contrary to what my informal survey indicated, is to build relationships with people. And in the context of a relationship, one is given the opportunity to refine one's own thought processes, ideas, and presuppositions. Here's how it might go. I was recently on one side of this conversation, and it went well. It took place between myself and a coworker, and I won't say which speaker I was, but I've invited Ben up here to be the other one. Do a little role play. Okay?
I am interested in hearing why you decided to vote for candidate A. I know we may not agree, but I don't want to change your mind. I just would like to hear your thought processes.
Well, for me, it's all about the makeup of the Supreme Court. I feel strongly that our country is heading in a dangerous direction, and ultimately the important decisions end up in the laws in the Supreme Court anyway. So I want a president who will nominate judges who are likely to decide cases from a perspective that's important to me.
Okay, that makes sense. I can see why that might be important to you.
May I ask why you're choosing candidate B?
Well, for me, it boils down to character and integrity. I realize that most politicians stretch the truth a bit and play to their support base, but I am concerned that candidate A has gone a bit too far, at least in my opinion. While I don't disagree with everything candidate A stands for, there are some things that have been said that concern me about candidate A's integrity.
So for you, character is more important than issues?
Well, that's hard to say. Ideally, I think both are important. I just think a lack of integrity is a dangerous thing in a president, or at least that's how I see it.
I guess everyone has a tipping point, something that ends up being of highest importance.
I think so. Ours are different, but I really appreciate your honesty. It gives me something to think about.
Me too. Talking like this helps me clarify my own thoughts and consider things I hadn't considered before. Thanks. Okay. That was admittedly kind of stilted because I tried to, you know, cleanse it of stuff. But anyway, we did get through the conversation, and it opened doors to many others. We still don't agree, but our relationship has increased because I know what is important to her, and that helps me. She knows what's important to me. So at the end, though there was no agreement, there was an understanding, and there was a depth, and there's the possibility of continuing the conversation on to deeper levels. The art of conversation includes some common elements, I think. The first is be curious and open to learning. In that particular conversation, I learned something. I learned a perspective that I didn't have, and I learned that although it wasn't of the most importance to me, it was also important. Listen attentively to the idea of learning as opposed to formulating a rebuttal. I mean, how many of our conversations are that, really? You say something to me, and I think I can counter that with this, 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 and this. And you may have changed the subject by the time I get ready with my rebuttal. When we hear a perspective that's different from our own, we have the opportunity to modify, change, refine, or solidify our own opinion. And that's what growth is really about, isn't it? When someone shares their opinion with us, it's a gift. It's not something to be countered or disagreed with. It's something to take in and realize that that person is sharing something that is their heart. And whether we agree with it or not, we should accept it as a gift. We should receive it with respect. We should also show respect to the person and suspend our own judgments. Be careful not to hijack the conversation. I mean, even in agreement, how many times have you shared something and someone said, oh, you know, I had the same situation, and boom, off they go, and it's there, and you're thinking, I had something to say. We're hardwired to judge, aren't we? I mean, it's in our DNA. So if a lion pops out from behind there, we're all hardwired to adjust or assess the threat and run out the door, right? But there's no lions in conversations, really. They're just words. And the judging capacity gets in the way of forming, of taking in new information. So as I'm judging you, I'm not allowing the information to get to me. So A, I'm not getting to know you. And B, I've missed out on the opportunity to change my own mind if that needs changing. So learn the art of placing judgment on the shelf for a while, allowing yourself to fully take in another perspective. Opposite perspectives should not be feared. One of my closest friends, excuse me, she and I were on the opposite side of the political spectrum for a long time, a very long time. But there was no judgment there, and we could talk about things and say, you know, how did you come to that conclusion? And really honor what the other person said. Show respect to the other person, always, in any conversation. It's just the right thing. Note any common ground as well as difference. There's nobody that you completely disagree with. Now, I have a Mormon cousin, and we have the most awesome discussions about religious topics. We decided decades ago that we were going to start with what we agreed on. So we kind of mined that. And after decades and decades, she's not become a Protestant, I've not become a Mormon. But I know more about her. And some of her suggestions and values, especially in terms of family values, they've really made a difference to me. You know, and occasionally we do make pot shots. She found out we were at a vineyard, and she said, "Oh, is that where they bark and growl?" And I'm like, "No." And I said, "But don't make me bring up the underwear." And so, and we had a relationship that would let us laugh about that. Learning the art of placing judgment on the shelf allows you to fully take in. So neither of us changed positions at all. But our understanding of each other as people is a lot deeper than it used to be. Ask clarifying questions. Many times what seems to be an argument can be boiled down to differences in semantics. Words contain baggage, don't they? I mean, we all bring our own baggage into them. Take the word diversity. Just think about, what does that mean to you? Well, if you boil down the word diversity to its simplest form, it basically means a condition where differences exist. So we're having a potluck after the service today. We're going to have a diverse menu, okay? That's diversity. But because of our culture, diversity has all sorts of different things, and you say diversity to someone and they hear, "I am a racist." Okay, all it means is difference. It is a good idea when you're having a conversation to take the time to unpack what words mean, because then you know that you're talking about the same thing. Questions like, "Tell me more about that," "I'm not sure I understand what you mean when you say," "Can you say more about that?" "How do you define?" You want to try to avoid saying, "So what you're saying is," and then do a polar opposite. You know, I say, "I really like macaroni." "So what you're saying is you hate chocolate cake?" "What?" Be willing to hold your own opinions until it's your turn. Now, depending on how strong the conversation is, if you really care about the person, you may want to suspend your own opinions for another time and just let them talk. That is a gift to that person. And it is a gift to you because you can fully hear them. But what if they're clearly wrong? Because sometimes, you know, it happens. And we're not just talking politics. We're talking other things as well. Sometimes someone holds an indefensible opinion. I thought of throwing in Hannibal Lecter, you know, his idea of what it is to have a dinner party. You know, that might need some correction. But most of us aren't in a conversation with Hannibal Lecter, which is good. That's why most of us are still here. I believe it's most effective if a correction happens in the course of building a relationship. Don't you? Wouldn't you rather have someone speak into your life that you knew loved you and cared about you and was worried about your best? And we need time to build trust. And trust does not get built when you're hammering at each other in an adversarial way. Once you do that, your voice is silenced in the ear of the other person. They don't feel safe. And we need to be so careful about our agendas. When I first came to the Lord, it was a long journey, and I would hope that many of you would not believe right now how I was before I came to the Lord. Because I think I've changed. But I was the wild child that every mother hopes her child will never be. And I met this gal. Her name was Melba. And she was a Christian. And I was intrigued by her life, but not really interested in it because it was so contrary to how I was living. And I had a feeling that all the rules and regulations she went by were not going to, well, they would change my life considerably. And I didn't want to change. But she never talked about Christ. We talked about music a lot because she was a music major as well. And she talked about what was important to me and what was important to her. She talked about how we lived our life and how we felt empty or how we felt full. And in the midst of all of that, we became best friends. And one day when I was struggling with something, she says, "Where do you go when you're struggling like that?" And I said, "I don't know." And she said, "Can I tell you where I go?" And she did. And over the course of months, I began to realize that's where I wanted to live my life as well. Relationship. She didn't argue. She didn't back me into a corner and quote 4 spiritual laws at me. She loved me, and I felt safe with her to be vulnerable to this, to the extent that I could say, "I don't have all the answers. Can you help?" That to me is evangelism. I also had a friend who was walking down the wrong path at one point. And I prayed, not learning from my own experience, I prayed that God would show me how to confront her because I was quite sure she was wrong. The word I got was, "In kindness comes repentance." That reminded me, just love her. Just love her. Let God do the correcting. And in time, I would be able to say, I don't feel really comfortable doing that because, you know, it turns me away from some of my own priorities. And one day she said, "My life isn't working." And I said, "Well, tell me more about that." And she said, "I want to live the life the way you live yours." And then we had a conversation. Who knows? Had I confronted her earlier on, maybe she would have turned earlier and maybe some of the pitfalls she went through wouldn't have had to happen. I don't know. But this seemed like a gentler way to go. One of the values of our church is peacemaking. And peacemaking doesn't always mean we agree. If your difference of opinion, let me say it differently, the fact that you have a difference of opinion from mine doesn't diminish me as a person. It doesn't make me less than. It doesn't change the value of who I am. It doesn't change the value of who you are. It doesn't diminish your value. It just means we think differently. Can't we do that in peace? Can't we do that without the arguments and what's going on in Washington? Can't we just do that? We are coming up to another election season, and no doubt you'll be provided with a zillion opportunities to put some of these things into practice. Try one or two. When you find yourself in a conversation, ask yourself this: what do you really want from the conversation? Do you want a relationship, or do you want to be right? What do you want to put into it? Do you just want to win, or do you want to share your soul? Is the person more important to you than the position? Is it possible that you could learn something through listening rather than talking? I want to end with a verse in Proverbs. And as the worship teams comes up, I want to just leave it on the screen for a few minutes and let you chew on it. Proverbs 18:2. "It is folly to avoid learning from others. Wise men and women listen to others rather than just listen to themselves talk about their own ideas." Learn the art of conversation.